so stupid. He comes across in front of me every single time he overtakes. Where does he want me to go off the track?
No!
Stop talking to me in the braking zone.
Okay, what in the hell is going on, Formula One? Let's roll the titles. It's Motorsport 101.
I
cannot
believe
you are the world champion! I don't even know where to start with this one. I've got to be honest with you, I'm not the best intro to a podcast maker as a podcaster in the first place. I'm not the best with intros as it is, but I'm going to be honest with you here, this one. This is a bit of a behind-the-scenes factoid. We're just totally going to wing this episode because, holy shit, we've had three enormous breaking news stories in the last 3 or so hours. And we originally taped shows on Monday. Because of Skype technical problems, we didn't actually record this on Monday. We're recording this now on March 23rd on Wednesday. And it might be the best thing that could have possibly happened to the show because, holy shit, have we got a lot to talk about. First of all, let me introduce my co-host as always. First up in the blue corner, Mr. Adam Johnson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. And I kind of feel like we're in, you know, that bit in Terminator 2 Judgment Day when we see the future post Skynet with the apocalyptic wasteland spreading out in front of us. I kind of feel like that's us right now observing the F1 community. And also, just to follow up on what Dre said, we are using a new bit of kit today because Skype can just go die in a fire. How it's not been responsible for my murder at the hands of Dre, I'm not entirely sure, but we did manage to get some replacement software working. This is our first time using it. We tested it thoroughly 15 minutes before recording. So far, all working good. Cross your fingers that Discord comes through for us. So yes, this is gonna be fun.
Yeah, it's looking great on our end so far, so we can't complain. And in the red corner is the voice of America himself, Mr. Ryan King. Hello, sir.
Wait, just give me a second. I gotta turn off my IndyCar YouTube feed because I'm watching a race right now.
Real professional, King.
Hang on, you're watching a race for free? You monster.
I think you can see where this is going, gentlemen.
maybe a little bit.
Okay, so let's cut to the chase. The list of things on the show, like, it was dramatically different as of about 4 hours ago.
We basically just ripped it up and set it on fire.
It's now a nuclear holocaust, basically, because now it's basically a totally different list. We're talking about Sky as they announced their decision literally an hour ago that they're going to air all races exclusively from 2019 onwards.
In
the UK at least. We'll be talking about the GPDA statement on the F1 decision-making process. We'll be talking about the Australian Grand Prix, its qualifying fiasco, and now the new breaking news story about they're going to tweak the format as opposed to get rid of it. So that's going to be a big story. We're going to be talking about all the positive stuff from Australia, like the tyre strategy actually working, the not so positive of the Alonso Esteban Gutierrez crash, Haas scoring points, Max Verstappen blowing his lid, etc., etc. And we may or may not talk about MotoGP in Qatar. We may save that till next week because who knows how long this first segment is going to go on for? Holy crap. So there's no guarantee that I'm going to talk about MotoGP here. I might have to call an audible on that one because, boy, like I said, the entire plans for this episode changed about an hour ago. And again,
I feel like we're like a SWAT team that has been called into a building under siege right now.
Yeah,
it's just all the major issues in F1. F1 is just kicking off majorly, and we're at the front doors about to throw stun grenades and storm the front.
Yeah, like, I deliberately wanted this to be as early a recording as possible because I wanted our responses and reactions to be as genuine as possible for this because I feel like it would make a better show than maybe waiting a day and then, you know, sleeping on it and thinking like that. I mean, let's cut to the chase. First up, leading the way, was announced, again, literally 6:04 p.m., according to the skysports.com website in the F1 section, And the headline, Sky Sports to show every F1 race live from 2019 to 2024. I will read a little bit of the statement. Sky Sports has extended its partnership with Formula One to remain the home of F1 in the UK and Ireland until 2024. As part of the new deal, Sky has agreed a new broadcast partnership with Formula One management, strengthening its position as the home of sport, offering unrivaled choice for fans.
Stop it, Sky. You're killing us.
Yeah. It's Sky Sports' new partnership with Formula One. Exclusive. Sky Sports will be the home of Formula One in the UK and Ireland from 2019 to 2024, offering live coverage of every Grand Prix. Free to air, the British Grand Prix, together with highlights of all other races and qualifying sessions, will be shown on a free to air basis. Sky Sports Mix. Additionally, at least two other prime time live races a season will be offered on the soon to be launched Sky Sports Mix channel, along with other F1 content. Ultra HD. For the first time, every race starting with the 2017 championship will be shown in the stunning picture quality of ultra high definition via Sky Q, the next generation home entertainment system. Sky Sports F1 will continue to be the only place to watch Grand Prix weekends live for the next three seasons in the UK, with 21 races live in 2016, beginning with last weekend's Rolex Australian Grand Prix. The new agreement builds on the success of Sky Sports F1 since the launch of the award-winning channel in 2012. More than 13 million viewers have already enjoyed its live coverage, with many more following F1 across Sky Sports digital outlets. One more thing from Bernie, CEO of the Formula One Group, saying, I'm delighted that we will continue to work together. Sky's commitment to the sport and standard of coverage is second to none. Fellas, holy shit. As you can imagine, the reaction to this news, obviously we follow a lot of British F1 fans in this country, has been nothing short of nuclear.
It's been toxic.
It's been ridiculous. I was on the phone on my bus home from work, and everybody was kicking up a stink about this one. And it's hard to even begin where to start with this, but initial impressions on my end is that this is an awful deal for F1 fans. I mean, it's understandable in context why this has happened.
I think we could all see it coming, couldn't we?
Yes, I know. I know. I saw it coming. I know you guys saw it coming. I know friend of the show Lewis Sutherby over on Bike Live just tweeted himself that it was only going to be a matter of time, really, that before Sky, before, you know, they would turn the screw on something like this and, you know, really try and shut out any and all competition. And
as soon as the joint deal back in 2011 was announced and BBC went from being the exclusive broadcaster to a sort of half deal, it really stunk of BBC are only keeping hold of their paltry amount of coverage. They're doing the least amount to fulfill the agreement with the Concorde agreement. I believe it was, to have F1 at least on some free-to-air in some capacity. And it always felt like that was literally just enough to satisfy that agreement. And if Sky could just do it all themselves, they would. And as I say, we could kind of predict this coming. And it's kind of one of those things where it's like, yeah, we kind of knew this would happen one day, but still, it kind of sucks considering that from 2019, it'll be the first time that Formula One won't be on free-to-air full-time in really any capacity, bar this, you know, British Grand Prix and a few of the token other things, since 1977. Mm. That was the last time that Formula One really wasn't on live free-to-air television.
And it wasn't on TV, period, before that.
Exactly, yeah. So this is for many people, you know, for some, you know, and I remember this when the deal was announced that it would be going to Sky in 2012. There was a huge backlash against it, but there were a lot of people saying, oh, well, you know, you pay for what you get, you know, true fans would pay anything to support it. I'm like, no, that just sounds like someone who's, you know, which side of my face do you want to stamp on because I'm such a good little fan? I didn't like that. And
it's wishful thinking. I mean, we don't live in a society where we have all this disposable income anymore. And yeah, like, we're living in a new age. The internet is getting bigger and bigger year to year. Like, we're finding what I like to call totally legal sources.
Which are only going to increase with this deal. Let's be real.
Of course, absolutely. I mean, why would you ever want to pay £30 for Sky Sports when you can watch whatever game you want on the internet for free if you know what you're doing?
Between this and the statement from the Conservative MP about closing the, in inverted commas, loophole about watching BBC iPlayer for free, are students going to be able to watch anything legally now? Let's be real. Except for Netflix, maybe. They'll be prepared to pay that. But otherwise, I don't see it. 130, whatever it is, for a license fee to watch iPlayer, to watch Doctor Who reruns. And then 40 quid or nicking their parents' Sky Sports login. This is... I mean, that's the big thing about it. Like, it's... You know, for some people, they're not prepared to pay it out of principle. And that's fair enough. But for many, including, I'm pretty sure, us in this conversation, it's a physical deal. Like... People are going to be put in the situation where their love of the sport is going to go alongside food, bills, rent, you know, these sort of basic things. And it's like, can you justify, I mean, the cost is pretty high anyway, considering what you're getting into with Formula One. It's not like football where, you know, the sheer amount of it means that, hey, you can probably justify it because there's games every weekend, there's midweek games, there's other games, there's preseason friendlies, everything's on there. Formula One, you're basically 21 weekends of a year is what you're paying for. And that's likely to go up with this deal. When Sky Sports become the exclusives, hey, there's going to be no one else in town to challenge them, so they can charge literally what they want. They're the only circus in town. And I don't know, like, the biggest thing for me, and this is backed up by evidence around, you know, around the world, the big thing that's going to take a hit here is the viewing figures. And unquestionably so. The big thing with free-to-air television is that it is exposure like nothing else. And when Formula One moved in 2012, if I remember rightly, the viewing figures were literally went down by about two-thirds on Sky F1. And as far as I know, they haven't improved. And it was exactly the same in Australia when the V8 supercars moved from free-to-air to the Foxtel subscription service. Their viewing figures absolutely just plunged. They were literally getting sub 1 million on quite a few of their broadcasts when they were getting healthy 5, 6 plus million viewership in 2014. And they're still taking the hit for that. Granted, you know, Foxtel and in this case Sky are clearly pumping money into the sport. But overall, you know, motorsport, particularly sponsors, they get into motorsport for visibility. They want to know that their product is being watched and seen and their, you know, logos are being seen by as many people at any time as possible. This is going to hit that. This is going to impact it. And I don't know. This is, you know, is Formula One big enough to survive that? Probably, because you can't really kill it with a stick. But it's going to leave a sour taste for a lot of people. This is not good. For the common man, this is not good.
Yeah, but Johnson, it's a pretty big stick because you're talking about potentially 2 million plus viewers, because Channel 4 released their first TV ratings for the Australian Grand Prix today. And it was, they peaked at 2.7 million for the Channel 4 highlight package they released of the race. And it wasn't a live race. I think Bahrain will probably be a little bit more representative in a couple of weeks' time, because of, obviously, it's their first live weekend. So obviously people will probably make more of an effort to tune in knowing it's live.
Well, if I remember rightly, this is just going off my memory. I remember reading at the time that at the peak of it being on BBC, back on BBC in around 2010, I'm pretty sure they were getting near to 10 million per broadcast, certainly around 8 or 9 million. And as soon as it went to Sky F1, because, you know, as we've discussed, people can't physically get Sky F1, so, you know, it's not a case of people deliberately turning away. It's because they can't get it. It was down to around the 2 or 3 millions for live broadcasts, so they took a big hit in terms of raw viewership.
If you're not a particularly big sports fan and you are only really maybe into F1 and not much else,
why would you pay for it?
Yeah, you got to pay £30 a month for it. That's £360 over a year. Like, that is a very, very hard thing to justify.
And consider this. You know, think about what you pay £10 a month for. Maybe you're prepared to pay £10 a month for Netflix, which has a huge library. Amazon Prime, that's going to have a huge library, now exclusive. WWE Network, that has everything live on it, plus archives of everything, exclusive content, the lot. This is £30 a month for not a huge amount in between the races. Let's be real. They do some of the exclusive stuff in terms of the driver interviews, behind-the-scenes stuff, the F1 show with Natalie Pinkham. But even so, 30 quid a month and possibly rising, this is difficult. And going on another series. I mean, as I say, we're talking about F1. We're talking about the top dogs around the world. As I say, are they big enough to be killed by viewing figures? Potentially, but unlikely. However, domestically, let's look at a series that has really proven the value of free-to-air broadcast, and that's the British Touring Car Championship. In the mid-2000s, in the 1990s, during their peak, they were on BBC Grandstand with a sort of as-live coverage. They were sort of edited highlights just after the real race had happened. So it was almost live, and they were doing very well. Mid-2000s, they went off of free-to-air. They were on sort of, you know, the sub-channels. But in the last few years, certainly in the 2010s, they've been on ITV4, which has been on Freeview. So effectively, it's been free to air. And they've had a lockout of Sunday afternoons, you know, showing every support race, every touring car race. You know, it's been all there. Look at where the championship is now. They've just announced a record field for 2016. There's teams and drivers entering all the time. You can't tell me that being on free-to-air and picking up 4, 5, 6 million viewers every weekend they race hasn't helped that series.
No.
Because it absolutely has.
King, like, talk to me, man, on this one, because I know it's different for you because obviously you're in the States and I know that the F1 is on NBC and whatnot, and it's hard. It's a hard one to fathom because me and you have both said many times before, like, live sport is the last bastion of television, in my opinion. And, like, TV as we know it, I think, is dying a slow death when it comes to the internet and, you know, modern technology in 2016. But, like, putting F1 behind such an enormous paywall can't be a good thing, can it?
No, I mean, it... Yes and no. Like, yes, it doesn't benefit the sponsors anyway, but Formula One management is not affected by how many people watch F1. They're affected by how much broadcasters pay to show F1 on television. And without a doubt, this is a good move for them because, like, even over the past couple of years, I think the TV rights this year for F1 in the UK is about £55 million. And back in 2006, it was, you know, £30 million. So it's almost more. So it's almost doubled over the past 10 years.
Yeah, so basically the FOM isn't manipulated. Well, like, we talk about ratings. The ratings is going to be the knock-on for the broadcaster, because obviously that are paying for these rights as opposed to the FOM, which are basically getting a flat fee to show F1 with that broadcaster for that season. So obviously, for the FOM, it's a great deal. For Sky, they're going to assume it's a great deal as long as the ratings are there. The entity that takes the knock-on is going to be the fans here, because now ultimately, you've got to make a choice. Do you want to pay £30 a month for the convenience of having Formula One in high def, or maybe ultra high def on this new Sky Qbox has been advertised lately? As again, that's going to be friggin' expensive knowing what Sky's like whenever it releases something new when it comes to tech. Or do you go by the totally legal methods, or do you go basically just saying, you know what, I can't do it, I can only watch reruns that don't really matter so much? And, you know,
let's be honest,
really...
£30 for most people is a mobile phone bill.
Yeah, roughly, I'd say. Yeah. So for the average person, yeah, that's a phone bill, and that's something that's actually important. You know, so it's, there's not much more to really say about this, really, besides, holy shit. And like I said before, it's the last bastion of television for me is live sport. And there's always going to be a demand for live sport, especially the bigger ones like football in this country, like Formula One, like the rugby, et cetera, et cetera. And it's an enormous deal. It's gonna hurt. It's going to take the fan of this one full force. And gosh, it's like Sky better have a plan for expanding in F1 soon after this one, because they've now got to take the hit when it comes to TV rights and whatnot, because they've paid more and more for this coverage. And, you know, I don't see where the fans are going to come from. And I think it was a friend of mine, Chen, on Twitter that made a very good point. If you're a new fan and you want to make the investment into Formula One to watch it live, because there's no alternative to watching it live. I mean, you're not going to tune into a sport to see it pre-taped and watched a week later. No one's going to do that.
Having dodged Twitter for spoilers.
Exactly. That's the kind of era we live in, so we want it now. So to watch it live, you're going to pay an enormous amount of money. Like, even if you go down the Now TV route and pay for a day pass, like an F1 race, that's £8. So you're looking at 21 times 8. That's £168 for the year to watch every F1 race live, even if you're going by the day pass method on Now TV. It's an enormous amount of money for the average person.
And on Sky Sports, that's like £360 a year.
Yeah, it's an enormous deal, and it's only going to get bigger. I feel like you said, it's only going to get bigger in time once Sky, in 2019, when they announced their biggest deal. Like, Sky's not going to drop prices. Of course they're not. They're a business. They're going to keep growing. You know, they're never going to drop prices, especially not an entity as big as that. Hmm. Sure, they'll offer deals every once in a while to try and get people through the door, but ultimately, a customer is a customer. And, you know, once you're in, it's very hard to walk out from a Sky deal or things like that, because they'll try and convince you to stick around, like it's happened to my parents. Mm. On many occasions. So yeah, not much more to really say on that, but like, I think the biggest hamper for me as a fan when it comes to this is that the internet's going to get completely ignored until 2019. After this, there is no chance the internet ever gets some kind of exclusive streaming deal for Formula One, or, you know, like a WWE Network-esque or a, you know, Netflix-esque kind of deal.
Which I think is a shame. I think people were hoping that they would gradually move in that direction. But then again, this is Formula One, who historically have been pretty slow to adapt, and I think this kind of proves it.
We didn't even have HD on board until this season, for God's sake.
This season?
Yeah.
Whoa, are you kidding me?
This is the first season we've had onboard cams in high definition.
Oh,
that should tell you all you need to know.
Wow. So, okay. Yeah, no. Well, it was only last year that they worked out the idea of, you know, the T camera on top of the driver's pod?
Yeah.
You can swivel that 360. Like, you know, IndyCar's been doing for God knows how many years. So, yeah, no, Formula One are slow to adapt. And I think this move really says that they are determined to make the most of their investment right now rather than think of any future plans.
They want that guaranteed money, and that's what they're going to get with this Sky deal. They're going to get at least $55 million a year for at least another 8 years. So the FOMs, they've made their guaranteed money out of Britain now. It's up to Sky to decide where they can get their money back on this investment. So that's what's going to be interesting going forward. But yeah, it's a shame. I'd have happily paid £10 a month for an F1-esque kind of streaming service like the WWE Network, like Netflix or an Amazon Prime or whatever.
Would.
So, yeah, I'd have no problem paying that money at all. So that's a bummer. And the whole deal, in my opinion, is a bummer. But hey, we get the British Grand Prix for free. That's nice.
Yay.
Yay. Shut up, King. You don't get to laugh. You get to wallow in our British pity.
Yeah, I think NBC showing 4 races for free this year.
Oh, fuck you.
And which ones are there? I bet they're pretty good ones. They're not like Silverstone, China. Help me. What other boring ones are there? Monza? Yeah, possibly. Go on.
We usually get like the races on our continent plus Monaco. So I think we're getting
Brazil,
Canada,
Mexico. You're getting Canada, USA, Mexico, and Brazil. That's a good deal.
Yeah,
that's not bad at all. I would happily take.
Actually,
that.
No, we're not getting Brazil this year. We're getting Britain. So yeah,
okay. You're in with us.
Okay. We're in this together, King, as an honorary Brit. You will wallow in our self-pity. It was already bad enough on Twitter when I was getting the usual American cousins from the grid girls. Shout out to Sarah Connors, as always, mocking us.
She was just getting a payback for us last week, just spending 20 minutes mourning Connor Daly. That was a payback. Also, King, while I've got you here, I watch a lot of NASCAR, obviously, but I'm curious to know, I vaguely know about the TV deal. You'll be able to help us out here. What's their TV deal like in terms of how many races of theirs are on free-to-air television?
Off the top of my head, there are 36 races, so 13 of them are on free-to-air. The other 23 are on pay TV.
That's interesting. So that's, you know, so Fox have their X amount of races. They'll have a certain amount on free-to-air, and the others will be on Fox Sports Go or 1 or 2, whatever it is. I see. Okay. So that's quite interesting.
And the same thing with NBC. They have part of their races on NBC, which is free-to-air, and NBC Sports, which is pay TV.
That's very interesting.
Similar deals to what F1 kind of is now in this country. So, yeah, okay, interesting. But that's all on the TV deal. Next, breaking news story number 2 of 3.
Wait, give me a moment to recover. Whoa, hang on. I need to... I'm limbering up for this one. We've just gone through the TV deal.
I'm doing some reading, so you can take the next 3 minutes out. So, the Grand Prix Drivers Association made a big announcement on their Twitter account about... Well, we've gone to the tweet about 5 hours ago now at the time of recording.
Can I just say, before you continue, I think what was quite funny is that I think everyone had the same reaction in that, oh, the GPDA said something, they've had an announcement. This is probably some more about copy protection or something, who knows. That? Oh, okay. So yeah. That's what they were... Right, I wasn't expecting that. Dre, what was it that no one was expecting them to say?
Yeah, here we go. I'll read you the statement in full from the GPDA itself.
The hashtag of, from the GPDA.
Yeah, the hashtag of Racing United. Here we go. This was released literally today, March 23rd. Driver position statement. Dear Formula One stakeholders, followers and fans, the Grand Prix drivers would like to state our following position. We drivers love our sport. Since childhood, we dreamed of racing the fastest race cars from the top teams on the coolest tracks against the best drivers in the world. Aww. We see competition and love Formula One almost unconditionally, which makes us most probably the people with the purest interest for Formula One besides our fans. Also, this is a bitch to read in full because I'm using the Twitter screws up and I've actually zoomed everything in a bit. It's kind of annoying, but I'll soldier on. Formula One is currently challenged by a difficult global economic environment, a swift change in fan and consumer behavior, and a decisive shift in the TV and media landscape. This makes it fundamental that the sports leaders make smart and well-considered adjustments. Here's the big one. We feel that some recent rule changes on both the sporting and technical side, and including some business decisions, are disruptive, do not address the bigger issues that our sport is facing, and in some cases could, what's that word there, jeopardize its future success. We know that among the leaders of the sport, overhears that representatives, the government body, the teams of or other stakeholders, every individual acts with the very best intentions. Therefore, the drivers have come to the conclusion that the decision-making process in the sport is obsolete and ill-structured and prevents progress being made. Indeed, it can sometimes lead to just the opposite, a gridlock. This reflects negatively on our sport, prevents it from being fit for the next generation of fans, and compromises future global growth. We would like to regest and urge the... and all stakeholders of F1 to consider restructuring its own governance. The future decisions and future directions and decisions of F1, be they short or long term, sporting, technical or business orientated, should be based on a clear master plan. Such plan should reflect the principles and core values of Formula One. We need to ensure that Formula One remains a sport, a closely fought competition between the best drivers and extraordinary machines on the coolest racetracks. Formula One should be home to not only the best teams, drivers and circuits, with partners and suppliers fit for such an elite championship. Formula One has undoubtedly established itself as the pinnacle of motorsport and, as such, one of the most viewed and popular sports around the world. We drivers stand united, offer our help and support for Formula One to keep it as such, and further to make it fit and exciting for many years and generations to come. It is important to state that this open letter is intended in the best interests of all and should not be seen as a blind and disrespectful attack. Thank you for your attention and granting us the liberty to put our thoughts into words. Best regards, Jenson Button, Sebastian Vettel, Alex Wirtz, on behalf of the Grand Prix Drivers Association. Holy fuck.
The GPDA pipe bomb just got dropped.
That tweet has already been retweeted nearly 1,500 times at the time of writing. And it's king. There's no other way to describe it. It's an enormous announcement. Or at least a statement of intent.
This basically confirms what King said only on the last episode. Is there a power struggle in Formula One? Yes. I think that question's got answered.
Go on, King.
Yeah, I mean, the letter clearly states that they're not happy with the way things are. They don't say that they're going to do anything, but they clearly state they're not happy with the way things are.
Yeah, there's no getting around that. There's like, again, it's not. I know people are very quick to make the comparison to 1982 and the strike the drivers had, which was the grand total of a 1 day strike to protest the super license changes, where the super license deal was, if I'm not mistaken, King, was if you got a super license, you'd have to stay with your first team for 3 years, which. Yeah. Of course, is just kind of stupid, really. So, of course, the drivers went on strike. It was resolved a day later. No problem. Everybody was back racing again. Hooray!
Well, people did get fined, so...
They're racing drivers. Fuck it. But in any case... Ugh, wow. Where do you even start on something like this? Because... Like the statement is obvious enough. The drivers are not happy with the current decision making process, and we've spoken out about this before. As late as last episode, which was taped 10 days ago, that the decision making process is clearly broken. Going through the strategy group, where only half the teams get a say, and then you need a near unanimous decision for it to go forward. Then you got to go to the commission, which is a great big group of people that sit in a dark room like the Imperial Order, something out of Star Wars more than likely, where they make the decisions and it goes through, et cetera, et cetera. And we saw how it went a little bit pear-shaped of the qualifying team. We'll talk about that later on in the show. But King, I mean, this is the first case a major group or major stakeholder in Formula One has come out with such a, I'd say, pretty scathing statement saying, look, we don't like this shit. Something's got to give here, basically.
Yeah, and they're not happy with... It seems like they're not happy with it being basically just Band-Aid upon Band-Aid on a massive gunshot wound.
Yeah, it's like... It reminds me a lot of what Martin Brundle said on Twitter and on the Sky Sports F1 website, because, you know, I'm not... I've made it clear in the past, I'm not a big fan of Sky's coverage, but Martin Brundle's post-race columns tend to be very good after race weekends, and he said it himself that on Twitter that F1 needs a master plan going forward. It needs something, so to speak. It needs to build around a future plan of some kind. And like you said, you know, it's like you don't want to put a Band-Aid on a gunshot wound, and, you know, it's not going to solve the problem. And F1, I've said it many times, has fundamental problems going forward that needs to be addressed. And they're not getting taken care of. Instead, we're trying to tweak little things like the qualifying format. And I'm sitting here thinking, well... You obviously do care about the show to some degree. You do want to try and make the sport more entertaining. I mean, that's obvious. It's obvious. The teams and the drivers, they do want a more, you know, a more entertaining sport for fans. I mean, I'm not disputing that they don't care about us. The problem is they don't want to change the technical regulations in order for that to happen. They'd rather basically throw some gimmicks at the wall and see what sticks. And that's essentially what this qualifying format was, Johnson. And, you know, it's clearly gotten to the point where I know the GPDA, Alex Wirtz himself, who runs it, said that this wasn't a knee-jerk reaction to anything that happened this past weekend. It probably didn't help, to say the least. But this was brewing for a while, Johnson, and it's like it's finally come out.
This really was the straw that broke the camel's back, it feels like. This qualifying fiasco where we just had no idea, we still don't know. You know, just as soon as the decision's been made, it's been reversed. Any kind of proposals put forward have immediately been vetoed, because as we've said time and time and time again, why would any team agree to a rule that brings their competition closer to them? So any attempt to improve the show will inevitably neuter a team like Mercedes or Ferrari, one of the top dogs, and why on earth would they ever agree to that? So that's the big flaw in it from the start. I mean, over in NASCAR, as I've said before, when Gene Haas called NASCAR a dictatorship, everyone thought it was a criticism. In a way, it kind of wasn't, because NASCAR does have that central body that thoroughly researches and takes on the opinions of the drivers and the teams, certainly for what is best to improve the show and the racing, but then has full control to implement where they see fit. and they go forward. They have a healthy enough relationship with the drivers and teams so that, you know, if an idea doesn't work, the criticism comes back from the drivers and teams and they'll let them know, hey, this sucks. So, like, you know, group qualifying and things like that. And, it, you know, various ideas just that haven't worked the last few years. But conversely, like last year with the test about the downforce package, that was based a lot on feedback from the teams and drivers. But the ultimately, the rulemakers had the final power to make that decision. It feels to me like this scenario, I mean, it's a power struggle that's never really gone away. I mean, King will probably testify this. You know, going back through the annals of history, there's been flashpoints where there's been disputes with the drivers and teams and the organisers of F1. But over the last few years, it feels to me like it's been building steadily more and more. They've been, you know, recently there's been impasse over, or confusion over this qualifying format, which didn't need to be tweaked in the first place. It was the last thing that needed fixing. It was the ultimate question of, if it ain't broke, break it, try and fix it and make it better to make us look like we're doing something. And they fucked that up royally. It was disgusting, quite frankly. You know, this talk about the cockpit protection, it feels, you know, I feel that the GPDA are frustrated that not more efforts are being made in that area. It seems to be a tokenistic thing, you know, like a, oh, well, you know, trust me, we are working on cockpit protection. And you know, maybe for the GPDA, they're frustrated about that. But going back through the last few years, you know, maybe at the end of 2014, where we nearly lost, well, we lost Caterham, we basically lost Marussia as well until they rose from the dead. And in the last few years, we've had a consistent slew of this team have missed engine payments, normally Force India, this team are in danger of going bust, this team aren't going there, Lotus will have had bailiffs at their fucking truck last year. It just really didn't look good for the sport. This is not a sport that is in any sort of rude health right now, and it feels to me, I mean, you know, it's clearly not a sport in rude health. Its reigning champion slagged it off the day before the first round of the new season. It said MotoGP was better. On what planet in any other series would you get that coming up? It'd be like Kyle Busch on the eve of the Daytona 500 going, NASCAR kind of sucks at the moment, I'd rather be in IndyCar. What on earth? It was just ridiculous. You can slag off Lewis Hamilton all you want for saying that, but there's got to be something fundamentally wrong when the reigning champion says he'd rather be riding motorbikes. You know, no disrespect, of course, to MotoGP, but basically, you know, your reigning champion saying that the sport sucks. One of the greatest drivers of the last few years, last decade, Fernando Alonso, says the sport sucks. You know, this is just, I mean, Mark Webber has basically made a second career out of giving F1 a kicking after he's moved to the WEC. And, you know, let's not get into the fact that the last few years F1 has been fighting a sort of running battle with, you know, fans defecting to the WEC, which is, in essence, a completely different sport. It's endurance racing, it's, you know, against the clock, it's a completely different discipline. And yet, for many people, it's become the new Premier World Championship. How on earth has that happened on Formula One's watch? And I think for the GPDA, they must be sitting there going, we're the ones going out there every weekend, putting our, you know, bodies on the line, you know, putting our lives on the line, effectively. This is, you know, for all the safety advancements, this is still a dangerous sport. And for the drivers, by choice. So we're going out there doing this only for to get back and for you guys to be sitting on your hands doing nothing. That nothing ever gets done. We put forward proposals for safety, for entertainment, for the show, for the improve the spectacle, and to make it the damn pinnacle of world motorsport that it should be. And it just dies on its arse. Just any proposals die on their arse. Nothing ever gets done. It filters down to the fans who are in this constant state of frustration. You know, what on earth came of that survey that came out last year? I mean, it was absolute bollocks to begin with. It was bilge. But they almost seem to be like, yeah, we're listening to the fans, and then nothing happened from it. So there's only so long you can continue in this vacuum, and I feel like the GPDA have had enough, hence why they've dropped the pipe bomb today. So it's very much, you know, FOM and the higher ups in the FIA and Formula One, the ball is very much now in their court, and it'll be very interesting to see how they respond.
I don't think they are going to respond, King. Do you?
No, I mean, they don't have any reason to, unless the drivers, you know, go into open revolt, which I don't think anyone is afraid of.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, they're taking shots at the teams that are making these decisions, and the teams sign their checks. That's kind of a problem. And, you know, these guys are going to want to get paid at the end of the day. And I don't think the drivers are going to go on strike or anything like that, because that would just put the sport into total disrepute. And again, there's not very much you can gain from going on strike a lot of the time. So I wouldn't even go down and even entertain that kind of possibility. But what's, like, the FOM's not going to make a response to this. The FA's not going to respond to this. Like they're not going to get their hands dirty on this one. They're just going to let the drivers say whatever the hell they want, because they know the drivers have got very little say in all this. Very, very little say. And the FOM would probably look, or FOM and the FIA would probably just look better to just say nothing more than anything else, because if they say something, I think the fans are just going to point them and go, boo. King, like, I don't think anything's going to come of this, and I fear that it's kind of already dead in the water.
I don't know. If the drivers keep talking about it, if the drivers still keep it in the headlines that they're not happy about the governing structure, then there could be a change. And definitely, I think there would be a change if they decide to strike, because you can't automatically, in the course of a couple hours, replace 22 Grand Prix drivers.
But do you think the drivers would ever go on strike?
I don't think they would, but it's an option. It's an option
on the table. I mean, sure. I mean, it's a possibility, but hoy,
that'd be a serious game of bluff if they tried that one.
Yeah, and like, seriously, would all 22 dudes agree to something like that? I doubt it. Like there'd be too many guys in there that would see the opportunity of a weakened field and go, I can see some points here.
Yeah, but would the sport risk that? I mean, imagine that. I mean, imagine, look at the farce that happened in USA 2005, and that was not a strike. That was an issue over tyres that, unsurprisingly, no one could agree to a decision to solve it. So 14, something like, yeah, they're 14 or 16 of the
22
teams just went on strike effectively the race. They said, you know what, we're not racing, it's too much of a risk. And they were left with a six-car Grand Prix, and that's a farce that's still being talked about to this day. So if the entire field says, you know what, we ain't racing, it doesn't matter what GP2 teams you pull out at the last minute, there's going to be a riot from the fans' perspective, and it is going to be an absolute farce from the, and as much as we talked about earlier, what could kill F1 with a stick, that could, I mean, that is really not a good thing. That is going to, because you think about it, fan rage on its own is not going to change Formula One. These things on their own are not going to change Rome. It's when you affect the money men, you know, the people in charge of the TV deals, yes, we've just been talking about, the sponsors, the investors, the top guys who are wanting to see their return on their investment in the sport. If they see this thing falling into complete disarray, then they go, you know what, we ain't putting our money in that, we're going somewhere else. That's when the sport really starts to hurt.
Indeed, and again, it's just, I'm more cynical about it, I think, than maybe the rest of you guys are, but I agree. I think a strike would definitely be the best way to get some immediate action, but I think there's too many dudes on too many paychecks, and like, getting 22 dudes to unanimously agree on something is going to be a problem in almost any scenario. It's the reason why often you get 12 guys in a jury and they can't agree on anything either, and you need a unanimous decision until like maybe 6 hours go past, and then the judge will go, okay, we'll take a 10-2 majority, basically, because it's gone for like 6 hours already. So getting 22 people to agree on anything is difficult. But even so, it's interesting that a organization that the drivers have come out in unison and said, look, something's got to change here, because it's bad for the sport what's going on. Whether something actually changes, well, your guess is as good as mine. Fellas, let's talk about something more positive. The Australian Grand Prix!
Yay! Yay! Something good to talk about at last. Formula One did a thing right. Well, the race, anyway.
Let's talk about Saturday. Oh
no. I'm just going to go and off myself, guys. It was nice knowing you.
Yeah, okay. At least they've
resolved it and decided to bin the whole... Oh, no, they haven't. Oh, God.
Yeah.
Well, they kind of did. Maybe.
And then they didn't. And they've basically proven the GPDA right by just not being able to make a fucking decision if you stuck a gun to their head.
Yeah, it's... Okay. We can't talk about Australia without talking about Saturday. It's impossible. Saturday marked the debut of the new qualifying format. a format of elimination style qualifying where the first session was 16 minutes long. After 9 minutes, there'll be a driver eliminated every 90 seconds up until the end of the session, except for the end where you could fill in an extra lap anyway, like Julian Palmer did, which totally wasn't confusing to a casual viewer. So that would go on and on and on, etc., until you got to Q3. It was a 14-minute session, and obviously, again, eliminations after 5 minutes every 90 seconds. Eventually, you'd have a top two shootout for pole. Yay! King, I think it's fair to say it was an unmitigated disaster.
Yeah, when you end a session with no cars on track, it's a disaster.
It was a disaster. To put this into context, if you have not seen said qualifying session, maybe if you're not an F1 fan, but listen to us anyway, there was no cars on track for the final 4.5 minutes of that qualifying session. Fans were leaving 5 minutes early. Like, normally in a qualifying session, you get your most dramatic peak at the end of a session, obviously, after the checkered flag's gone out and everyone's getting their final banker laps in to try and go for pole. As Damon Hill quite rightly said, Lewis Hamilton could have flown his own checkered flag with 4.5 minutes to go. It had gone to a point where we were seeing guys like Daniel Ricciardo and Max Verstappen on the weighbridge with 3 minutes left. Vettel had left the garage and had actually had time to go to his motorhome and change into civil gear for the press conference after qualifying third on the grid. What an absolute farce. It was absolutely atrociously bad. I have never seen a situation on F1 Twitter where everybody unanimously had completely shat the bed on it. It was terrible in every conceivable way, Johnson. And no surprise, it had gone to a point where even team bosses like Toto Wolff and Christian Horner were standing there in unison saying, this didn't work. Like, I never seen it. Like, Channel 4 had their first ever broadcast about it, and they had Horner and Wolff in the same interview, and they both unanimously agreed it was wrong. They got it completely wrong, and they had to apologize to the fans for it. I mean, Johnson, I mean, we can't understate how bad this was it?
No, we really can't. And this is probably, as I say, the straw that broke the GPDA's camel's back, hence their statement today, their pipe bomb. This was just a really bad idea from the start. And it reminded me a little bit, although if anything, it was 10 times worse than the decision, I believe it was last year, by NASCAR to adopt group qualifying rather than single car runs. Now, in NASCAR, that system was fine, except when you got to the restrict plate tracks where not being the first car out was vital, because if you were the first car out, you were a disadvantage because everyone would draft off you. And you'd get crazy scenarios where guys would be desperately trying to draft for people. The pole winner would normally be the guy who was 14th in the pack, and almost every single session on restrict plate tracks would end in huge wrecks. And it was abandoned very quickly. But it was, if anything, even worse. And I don't want to see anyone try and say, oh, well, it was the teams trying to be clever. This is all the team's fault for trying to be fancy. No, go home. I'm sorry. Teams and drivers will do whatever they need to do to win. And if they've worked out in a session that doing this will give them an advantage or give them the best chance of qualifying, and if there is absolutely no point of them running again, then they're not going to. We've said this before, the teams and the drivers are not under an obligation to provide the fans with entertainment, and they weren't going to go out there just to run some laps, just to have a car on track. And for me, the really, really big issue here was the fact that laps were completely discounted as soon as these limits were hit. As soon as the five minutes went by or whatever, and one of these elimination rounds went by, which, by the way, in some cases would not even be enough to do a warm-up lap and a timed lap at some of the longer circuits later in the season. But basically, the point was, as soon as the clock went past that limit, the cutoff, your current lap was DQ'd. That was it. It was thrown out. It was gone. There was no... I think everyone assumed that, hey, this will make sense, because, hey, they'll probably let them finish the lap that they're on, right? Wrong. No, and that was the really bad. It was as soon as people realized that, they went, oh, right, this is shit.
Yeah, because you couldn't do that, because if you did that, you'd be refusing the driver the right to reply. That's the problem. Mm. And so, not to mention on top of that, like, the problem was, I think for me, is that to do two runs in quali requires five laps. You need to go out, hot lap, in, out lap, hot lap again. Even if you did a racing pit stop, which no team decided to do, because obviously you got to reset the car, put fuel back in the car again and whatnot, and send it back out. By the time you're doing that, you're looking at maybe 8 to 9 minutes. So that's roughly when the time elimination started anyway. So most of the time, you got one run. If you were caught out with the timing and your first run wasn't good enough, that was it. It's why teams at the start would often try and do two laps on the quali. Problem was, Pirelli's tyres aren't designed to do more than one hot lap in qualifying mode, because Kvyat said himself, yeah, we did a second lap, it was clean, but it was just slower. It's like the tyre life that isn't good enough in a Pirelli's peak performance to be able to do more than one quali lap at a time. So it was kind of like that really awkward fuel burning era of qualifying, like in 2006. It was just terrible in every way, wasn't it? There's no getting around this, is it? It's just
like people can't admit that there can be poorly designed games, like even board games like Monopoly. Like Monopoly is a terribly designed game, but so people choose not to play it. This is a poorly designed system of qualifying, so this should just be scrapped.
Yeah, like essentially, that's the long and the short of it, really. So you know, it's just one of those things. But wow, just again, it was so bad that the FIA and the team bosses got together. They banged their heads against the wall, hopefully, and basically said, "Okay, this is terrible. We're scrapping it for Bahrain." That took, I'd say, what, less than 24 hours after that qualifying session even happened, and it's amazing, King, that it took that for F1 to be totally unified on an issue and for them to act quickly. It took that. That's what it took.
It took fans literally walking out of the Grand Prix venue for a change to happen.
It takes. Maybe we should plan this out more often. If we don't like F1 a bit more, maybe we should just have an organized walkout during like Q3.
Maybe the Liverpool fans are off something.
Yeah, do it Liverpool style.
But guys, am I right in thinking the system isn't actually dead after all? They agreed to scrap the thing, and yet now I'm hearing that it could be back, or it might be half a thing. My God, my head hurts.
Yeah, basically, this is breaking news story number 3, and that motorsport.com revealed this literally about 15 minutes before we were set to record this podcast.
It's almost like someone knew we were taping today instead of Monday.
Yeah, it's like we've been blessed with this, but the FIA is now in talks again to not scrap the format, but to tweak the format, maybe to the extent of what the original plan was with Q3 on the 2015 system that is unchanged, because, you know, basically a straight up 12-minute shootout for pole in Q3 instead of the 14-minute elimination format where basically it was one run and half the fuel gets dropped out, so to speak. So there's talk that the format will be tweaked, brought back, and tried again. Like, King, is there anything that can salvage this format?
No, sorry.
like Johnson's straight up saying it can't be saved. I think it could be, but I think it's a reach. Anyone?
I mean, they said that they're thinking about it, that it could happen. It's not, they will bring it back. It could come back. They might tweak it so Q3 is the old system and Q1 and 2 is the eliminator system, but who knows? There could be other tweaks involved. But it said it could come back, it's still a discussion point at the table.
You know the whole thing about moving deck chairs on the Titanic? This is kind of like the Titanic having already hit the iceberg and to be most of the way into the ocean. You know, the main players have already died. Leonardo DiCaprio is already well drowned, frozen in the sea, and yet the FIA are still sat on the deck rearranging the deck chairs. They're like, no, hang on, if we just reposition them this way, we'll be fine. Glug, 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 glug. This is... Oh, my God. Seriously. If you hear a banging sound, that's me bashing my head against my desk repeatedly. No wonder the GPDA put out that statement. We're getting frustrated, and we're just people with microphones and opinions.
Yeah, I mean, I'm more in the camp of, okay, sure, you can tweak it, but it's not going to look good after what happened in Australia. And I stick with that now. I mean, sure, you can tweak it. I don't think it's a complete dead goose. Maybe if you open the elimination windows to maybe 3 minutes instead of 90 seconds, you could do something like that instead, and whatnot. Again, you can tweak it, but I think at this point, King, after Australia's unmitigated failure, it's not going to be a good look to even entertain the prospect of bringing this back. It was that bad.
I wouldn't say Q3 was definitely that bad. Q1, it was not so much. I could see there being some value in that. But yeah, everything else outside of Q1, maybe Q2, not worth even thinking about.
Even in Q2, there was no cars on track with 2.5 minutes left. So, you know, it was a mini version of what happened in Q3 because people have realized, oh, qualifying Q9, like P9 or P10 with an open choice of tire might be better value than qualifying P6 or 7. So, you know, there'll be teams that'll be legitimately content, like Force India was, to straight up say, you know what, we'll take going out in P9 and P10. Give us the open tire strategy instead and see if we can work something out here. So, again, I think the format in general is fundamentally flawed in many ways. But hey, let's see what they do about it. Oh, did we mention the way that Nico Rosberg actually won that Grand Prix? Is that worth mentioning?
And that the race was actually pretty good?
Yeah, the race was good. The race was great.
And that, hey, whoa. This, you might want to put seatbelts on your ears at this point, because this may blow them clean off your head. The FIA and the strategy group got something right with the new tyre rules.
Yeah.
I know. They got something right.
It's amazing. Understandably, this idea was met with pure cynicism, and people were genuinely really confused about this new tyre policy that Pirelli had brought in combination with the strategy group. It worked beautifully for this race, because having three potential tyres you can use mixed up the strategies. It didn't make the race too confusing to follow. And we genuinely saw Ferrari try something different. They tried an ultra-aggressive strategy of going with a super soft strategy as opposed to Mercs on the mediums, to basically try and upset the apple cart and try and catch Mercedes napping. And it very nearly worked. And that was the backbone of intrigue throughout the entire race. Yeah, we got some good passes and some good action further down the field despite all that. But we had a genuine battle for the front, and we had a race that was tense all the way through, and that included Vettel at the end trying to chase down a Hamilton that hit the cliff on his tires with 5 to go. So yeah, we got a wonderful finish to what was a great race across the board, mostly because of the Pirelli strategy group working. Again, failed to mention Nico Rosberg did win the race. I just thought I'd remind you guys again in case you'd already forgotten. His 4th race win in a row, his 15th career win in general, which means he's only one behind Sir Stirling Moss is the winningest driver without a world championship. So, yeah, suck on that, people that tell me Rosberg isn't a Hall of Fame driver. Get out of here. He absolutely caper. Is. Shut up. Rosberg took the win. Hamilton had kind of like the race from hell in terms of being stuck behind the rear arse of a Toro Rosso for 2/3 of the race.
Had a horrific start as well.
Those Merckx clutches really aren't great at all. And he finished in second, despite Sebastian Vettel bearing down him at a rate of knots, and you know, could have very nearly won the race if it wasn't for the Ferrari just getting it wrong on the strategy. I mean, I know hindsight is a wonderful thing, and I know people were burying Ferrari for getting this one so wrong. People, Merckx won this race last year by 36 seconds. Can you blame Ferrari for trying to go for the throat on this one? I totally understand, King, why Ferrari did what they did on this one, because you're not going to beat Merckx in a dogfight. You might as well roll the dice to try something different, right? Or am I crazy? Somebody, tell me I'm crazy or not.
No, I don't think you are. And I read somewhere that it actually, had the red flag not come out, the Ferrari strategy may well have worked perfectly. Is that correct, King?
Be around still?
I think we killed him off with all this controversy.
No, I mean, it seems like the strategy would have worked even with the red flag. It just seems like they had it in their hands and just let it slip.
Yeah, because to me, it seems like the second Supersoft stint was, I think, the one that killed them, because they had to prolong it to make the Softs a viable tire in the long run. They probably didn't foresee the cliff coming with Mercs with five to go. But again, like, I know TechCraft has tried to look and said, oh, like, Mercs know this medium tire better than everybody else's because they ran it so much in testing. My response to that is, you can't simulate Australia's conditions.
No.
So there's only so much you can read into something like that from Kravitz. And, you know, why didn't you just shadow Mercedes? And I'm like, you can't really shadow them either, because if you change tires in the pit lane during the red flag, they can change back. Like, you can play chicken on this one. And eventually you've got to commit to putting a car on the tires and sending them out there. So, and they lost Raikkonen as a potential blocker. So, you know, I think it was more Ferrari letting this one slip. I mean, what they did seemed sound to me on paper. And I think if Ferrari and Vettel had gone on to win, we'd have all held them as geniuses anyway, and we'd all be saying that Merck's got it wrong. So fuck it, it's whatever to me at this point. So
I enjoyed overall with this race, and this was prevalent throughout the field, certainly with the lead battle as well, what I really enjoyed is the strategic flexibility that these tyres provided, and I believe that's what, you know, the teams and drivers in this championship have been crying out for years. You know, over in IndyCar, they've had the whole soft tire, you know, prime option tire, if you will. But in terms of, they've also had refueling, they have fairly regular full course yellows in that. So they have more strategic flexibility in terms of that. And we see it all the time. We'll see guys do on different strategies coming through the field, reshuffling, you know, leaders will drop back and then come through and then do something else and do something quite interesting. And we had that here in Australia, which is normally not really the most kind of spectacular in terms of pure pyrotechnics and action. And this was a really interesting race. Constantly up and down the field, there were battles, there were cars coming through on different strategies. There was the flashpoints between Jolyon Palmer and the Renault and the Toro Rossos. There was scraps, literally, wherever you looked on the track, there was something going on. And the fact that the podium spots were not really secure or set in stone until about three laps to go, that's huge. Normally they've been in no doubt until past lap three. Pretty much that's been the podium set. There you go. Mercs, maybe Vettel. But this, you know, I mean, a great start helped. But this was just seemed to be a huge kind of breath of fresh air in terms of tactics, strategy, making things viable and enabling some raw racing, because guess what, guys? There's never been a period of Formula One where people went flat out first flag to last. The key thing is letting the drivers go flat out at important parts of the race. We saw this last year in IndyCar with Graham Rahal and his amazing charge through the field on an alternate strategy late on at Barber. Oh, my goodness, that was something for the ages. And Formula One has kind of, almost accidentally, stumbled on a formula which enables that to potentially happen. We saw a charge late with Vettel, could have had second, had things worked out well. This was very interesting. It also felt to me like the gap between Mercedes and Ferrari, performance-wise, had closed just enough to make Ferrari be able to trip up Mercedes with an alternate strategy or attack at the very least. They're probably not fast enough on raw pace. We saw that in qualifying, but they're just close enough to challenge. Last year, for a lot of it, they were just nowhere. If Mercedes didn't trip up, Ferrari had no answer. But this year, I don't know, Dre, it kind of feels like they're just close enough to potentially slip a banana skin.
Yeah, like Mercs tend to panic when it comes to strategic calls on occasions in the past. They've done that before. Last year, they were 1.6 seconds off Mercedes in qualifying. This year, they were only 0.8. So it says a lot that Ferrari have closed the gap. They were very competitive in Bahrain last year, where they're going to next weekend. And, you know, Raikkonen was only a couple of seconds off the win last year, despite Hamilton being up the front. And they do look closer. We're going to wait and see. Again, in qualifying, Vettel was only 0.3 off the top in Bahrain last year. So again, there's a possibility that Ferrari's up there. I need to see a little bit more first, but in any case, Pirelli and the new strategy made it viable. It brought guys into play, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And overall, it made for a very entertaining and dramatic race that had a battle for the lead from start to finish, and that's kind of what we all wanted. That's what the casual fans want to see. They want to see battles at the front between the people who matter, and that's kind of what we got here, and that's hardly a complaint. Oh, and by the way, Nico Rosberg won, I guess you forgot again already. So other highlight, yeah, shut up. I'm saying, yeah, but moving on again, the red flag was caused by a simply hellacious accident between Fernando Alonso and Esteban Gutierrez. Gutierrez seemed to change direction in the braking zone right at the last minute, and it seemed to catch Alonso out, and Alonso ended up driving over Gutierrez's rear wing at 190 miles an hour. He's gone over the top, he's hit the gravel trap, he's flipped the car over and into the barrier at very high speed. Very reminiscent crash to Martin Brundle's in the 90s and the Jacques Villeneuve Ralph Schumacher accident from 2001 that very sadly killed Marshall Graham Beveridge. It caused the red flag as all the debris after, as well. See, Alonso hit the left-hand wall first and then obviously going into the turn three gravel trap. But my word, King, an enormous accident, and one that definitely caught a lot of us cold.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely now the case study to why we don't have gravel traps everywhere anymore, because they just throw cars into the air and flip them.
Yeah, I know. Like, I thought what was amazing about this, like, of course, given recent talking and whatnot, that this discussion has been about the halo, obviously, and cockpit protection and whatnot. Of course, a lot of the sim racing crowd, I think, were very, very diligent on this one. Like, oh, this is why we don't need halos, etc. And I'm like, shut up, okay? And like, Alan McNish was strong on the other end, saying this is why we need cockpit protection because of this accident. And I'm sitting here thinking, you're targeting the wrong areas, gentlemen. The wheel tethers actually did their job very well in this case to keep the tires out of Alonso's cockpit. The issue for me is that, why do we still have gravel traps again? Like, there's no coincidence that every new track that's been built and is now on the F1 calendar doesn't have gravel traps anymore. There's no coincidence that Monza had the Parabolica tarmacked over to allow a greater degree of runoff. And it reminds me a lot, Johnson, of the two big incidents we had with barriers last season. Max Verstappen at Monaco, where he hit that turn one barrier about 170. And then the other one for me was Carlos Sainz hitting the wall in Russia, down in Sector 3. Luckily, only a concussion for Carlos. It could have easily been a lot worse. But they hit barriers relatively head-on and were largely fine, where the red flag incident in this race was caused by Alonso flying off into a gravel trap that obviously flipped his car over. So for me, the question I want to ask is, why do we have gravel traps again?
It's a very difficult one, isn't it? Because, you know, gravel traps, they provide a sufficient deterrent, you know, for running wide in that. And we've all had this argument about track limits and things. So, you know, tarmac runoffs, people abuse them and they go wide and they do the track limit runoffs. But now we're thinking gravel is just too much. You know, at the very least, a car goes off and is normally beached, so it has to be recovered. And at the most, it causes a car to dig in and flip, which sometimes is not the worst thing, because the rolling and the rotating kind of dissipates the energy. But, you know, it's slightly better in that way than a complete head-on impact. But at the same time, this still didn't look great. I mean, what was interesting about this is that at the time I was watching it, I actually put the word out on Twitter about whether IndyCar-style rear wheel guards would have helped in this scenario. And the general consensus, including me, was probably not. This was such a out-of-the-blue incident where Gutierrez moved across. Did Alonso converge? Who knows? This was very reminiscent to Mark Webber at Valencia, I want to say 2011. And he was impacting one of the Lotus Caterham, the old, you know, the Lotus that later became Caterham.
Valencia. That was Valencia 2011, yeah.
2011, yes. It reminded me a lot of that sort of incident. This is one of those incidents that's going to be hard to avoid, whatever happens. This was a slight potential error of judgment from both sides. They converged exactly the wrong time. You're absolutely right, Dre, to praise what has been good safety improvements. The tyres didn't go flying. They didn't go careering off. The bodywork relatively stayed intact. And, you know, we have talked about cockpit protection recently. We also need to mention the fact that over the last decade or so, drivers are now sat lower in the car anyway. So the sides are higher up. And certainly, you know, Alonso being able to tuck in like that meant that even if the car ended up top side up against the wall, once it had finished barrel rolling, he was still able to squeeze out and get out. And there was that iconic image of him sort of cramped getting out of the car. And the most touching thing for me was the fact that Gutierrez just went straight over and the two men hugged straight away. It was a real sense of race drivers understand what they're getting into every time. And, you know, Alonso has been one of the guys who's been kind of old school a little bit, in the sense of he does, you know, he will actively say, he's kind of been more in the F1 needs a bit of risk camp. So it was nice in this regard that the two drivers were kind of like, well, if we're going to say that sort of stuff, we have to live by it. And there's that mutual respect of, I'm glad you made that one, son, because that didn't look good.
Yeah, it was a very touching statement that Alonso made after the crash, where he said, I wanted to get out of the car as soon as possible, sort of, because I know my mother is watching, and I wanted to make sure that I was okay.
It's fair enough. I mean, imagine if either of us were in that crash. Our parents would be just doing their nutting at the TV.
I know my mother should be bricking it, right at that point in time. Yeah, it would be ridiculous. But, I don't think this merits or... establishes the Halo discussion. I think, again, I said on Twitter, I said, let us never stop having the conversation for ways to improve safety. I know people have tried to gun me down for this, and I've said, guys, I don't necessarily agree with the Halo. What I'm saying is, what we should be having is a conversation.
Exactly.
Let's talk about it, rather than saying, oh, we don't need this. No. No, I don't believe in that.
We need a balanced debate, and we had this when the Halo made the debut. We both called for balance. Let's not go so much in extreme fear-mongering one way or extreme conservative, no, nothing needs to change the other way. We just need balance on this one. We need calm heads. And in a way, having a discussion about safety immediately after a massive accident or potentially a fatal accident is not a good thing to do, because emotions are running high and no one's going to be thinking clearly. So for now... let's just be stoked that Fernando Alonso was able to make a joke on Twitter about reading a newspaper saying he was lucky to be alive.
That was great.
That was fantastic.
Great. That was a great picture. But let's talk about a little bit more positive news real quick here. King, feel free to go full American on us. Haas scored points on their debut.
Yes!
Sorry.
In the words of Gene Haas, we'll do better next week.
I love it.
The most arrogant American statement I've heard in some time, because the guy, like, Haas's original aim was, let's just get a car over the line in race one, let alone in P6 with Romain Grosjean for 8 points on their debut. So Gene Haas has it like, we'll do better in Bahrain next week. And I'm like, oh, for God's sake.
I think he had his tongue firmly in his cheek when he said that.
I'd like to think so, because I loved about that. I loved Romain Grosjean's radio message. It was like, guys, this is a win for us. This is a win. This is a win for us. And, you know, welcome to Formula One, Gene. And Grosjean was so over the moon, he didn't even know where he'd finished on the track as it all finished and as it all unfolded. It was the emotion in Grosjean's voice was wonderful to hear. And, a team that is obviously coming completely from scratch, very Toyota-esque. I think Toyota was the name that was dropped around a lot after this. That's another team that scored points in its F1 debut. I think that was, 2002, I want to say?
Yeah,
2002. I got my years right for once. Nice. Haas coming over the line in P6. A train behind him for what it's worth, because Haas effectively did not stop for that P6, because they were out there, they did not pit before the red flag, and they changed to the mediums and went the distance thinking, hey, if guys are going to stop once or twice more, maybe we can pick a few guys off and get some points here. And it worked. And King, that car ain't half bad.
No, not at all. It seems like it could be scoring points almost every race weekend.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves here, but They were able to hold off strong cars. They had Force India behind them. They had Williams behind them. They had Renault behind them, the Renault factory team back there. They had some good midfield cars behind them, unable to do anything. Obviously, the two Toro Rossos that looked very fast in the early going. But, overall, a brilliant debut for the Haas team. And, where to go, Gene and the team. They've worked very, very hard to get to this position so quickly. And for them to be rewarded with 8 points on their debut is a tremendous effort. And again, the car looks very solid indeed. So I look forward to seeing where it goes and whether they can keep this up, or whether this was just a one-time thing. But I think they've got potential there. Also, yeah. I love to mention as well, also I want to give him a shout out to mention to Dare to Be Different ambassador Ruth Buscombe as well, the strategist for the Haas F1 team, formerly of Ferrari, and the fact she's now probably got a restraining order out on Ted Kravitz after the post-race interviews, where I was like, the strategists don't talk, and she's running off to get away from the cameras. Kravitz is just chasing her into the Haas garage. Well, that was one of the funniest parts of the weekend. But
I tell you what, though, you have to give a shout out to Romain Grosjean, of course. And I say that because, I mean, the gratitude on the radio afterwards spoke volumes. Here's a man who, since 2012, still has to put up with jibes about being that guy who causes pileups on the first lap. Why people still say that, I literally have no idea. They need to go and get a lobotomy. But this is a guy who the last couple of seasons of his career have almost been a wash. The latter years of Lotus, they were a real struggle from 2014 onwards. In 2013, he was this close to breakthrough Grand Prix victories. He was seriously strong in the second half of 2013. 2014 was an absolute bust. We all remember him losing his temper in Singapore when he had yet another engine go south. 2015... similar amount. This was a guy who didn't know whether he'd still have a race team when he arrived at the racetrack to drive for. And the weekend that they had bailiffs surrounding the trailers and the haulers, he put the thing P3 at Spa. This is a guy who thrives in adversity. And in the off-season, moving to a brand new startup team, that's going to be a big, big decision for your F1 career. That many people must have viewed it as a at least a sideways step, let alone a backwards one, especially considering Renault coming in as a factory team now, taking over the Lotus operation. So the fact that he came home sixth, stronger than most of his finishes for Lotus the last couple of years, man, he must have felt good. That must have felt really good.
Indeed. Again, Grosjean's a real great driver, a real great talent, a good guy to have on the grid, and, you know, well-deserved after a couple of years of real struggle that wasn't really his fault at Lotus. He was almost punished for being loyal to the brand, despite that 2013 season where he was so great in the second half of it. But let's move on real quick and let's talk about Max Verstappen. The internet's favorite son. That may have actually spoiled a few people because Mad Max was in the house on this one because Verstappen, who, to be fair to his credit, was ahead of Carlos Sainz in the early portions of the race, kind of was hurt by a pit stop where Max seemed to make a last-minute call to change tyres. It hurt his pit stop. He was dropped behind Carlos Sainz, his teammate, and as Carlos Sainz came through the field and got to the back of Jolyon Palmer's Renault, Verstappen was going crazy. Basically, many F words were exchanged as he was basically talking about how the team would not give him the order for Carlos Sainz to move out of the way and give Verstappen a crack of being able to pass him. And Verstappen was heated about this, and we had a couple of he had a spin in the late going, and I think he almost he hit somebody and went off on the final corner.
He hit Sainz.
He hit his teammate in the closing stages of the race as well. He seemed to really lose his rag about this, and it didn't help further on as well towards the end, or the day after, I should say, after the Grand Prix, where he went out and said that it's not a big deal because normally I'd be miles ahead of him anyway. And I'm like, oh boy. Max not afraid to throw the shade in Carlos Sainz's direction here. A lot of people, I find it amazing that people want to discuss the maturity of an 18-year-old Formula One driver. Like, I saw people going out here, like, who were 15, 16 years old, coming out here saying that Max Verstappen needs to grow up. I thought that was hilarious in its own right, that pre-hormonal teenagers are out here trying to basically tell Verstappen to be more mature. But, King, have we all forgotten that we're dealing with an 18-year-old here?
Yeah, I think we have. We've forgotten an 18-year-old who basically got an F1 his second year into car racing. Like, he's... If there's anyone who has the right to be immature on the grid, he's probably the most likely.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned this on Twitter at the time, right? I said that Max debuted his first ever F1 drive was as a 16-year-old. I think it was the week before his 17th birthday in Japan last year. The year before, I should say, 2014. And my response to this whole situation was, He's had people tell him how great he is going to be for nothing but two solid years now. He's been told how great he is going to be, or how he could be a future world champion, how he's so entertaining because he's willing to take the chance on riskier overtakes and whatnot. Like, Johnson, like, are we surprised in the slightest, or should we be surprised that it's actually gotten to his head just a little bit, maybe?
I'm not sure. I mean, certainly you can excuse frustration coming out. I think, to be honest with you, this will have to be a learning experience, and I'd be very surprised if Christian Horner or somebody didn't take him to one side after those comments and said, hey, you're allowed to be frustrated at your teammate or us. Don't air your dirty laundry in public, son. That's not something pro drivers do. But hey, I mean, it's very comparable in a way to the Chase Elliott scenario in NASCAR. I know, I'm going to make another NASCAR comparison. But he was, you know, you look at Verstappen and Elliott, both sons of former drivers, both guys who were winning things by teenage years. I mean, Chase Elliott became an Xfinity Series champion in NASCAR in his rookie season, age 18. And is now taking over Jeff Gordon's ride, age 20. But last year, when he was running his second year in Xfinity Series, when he knew he was getting the 24 ride, there were moments of frustration. But it was very strange how, I mean, Elliott seemed to deal with it more internally. He seemed to blame himself for his poor performances, and he seemed to beat himself up. And, you know, you could sort of tell that there were people, you know, his dad knew the business inside and out, Bill Elliott, awesome Bill. He would have taken him to one side and said, son, it's fine. So for more season, you're going to get frustrated. You've had this amazing success for your whole career, and it's a very young career still. So it's inevitable. Just manage it. You'll be fine. And I feel like Jos Verstappen and the guys around Max, this is the time where they have a responsibility to really guide this kid, because, you know, it's inevitable. We get frustrated. We got frustrated as teenagers playing video games or on the bus. I don't know. It's doing something teenage related, let alone driving a Formula One car. So, of course, he's going to get frustrated. Throwing the shade at his own teammate, it's not a good look. So I feel like this was a heat of the moment thing. And I hope that Jos and Franz Tost and maybe Christian Horner just take him to one side and say, we understand your frustration. You're a hormonal teenager who's in Formula One and is touted as the next, was being compared to Ayrton Senna in his third sodding Grand Prix.
Yeah.
Of course he's going to have a little bit of an ego. Just chill and learn when to air your dirty laundry in public. So I hope this is a learning experience for him. I don't see why people need to get on his case massively. It's not like he said something really, really bad. No. It's natural. Formula One driver shows emotion shock. Goodness me.
Everybody gets mad on the radio every once in a while when things don't go their way. They're driving 220 miles an hour Formula One cars with 900 horsepower. Why are we surprised at this? And yeah, like I said it before, Verstappen is going to have an ego. He's had nothing but people tell him how great he's going to be for 2 years. It's got to his head a little bit. Understandable. He's an 18-year-old hormonal teenager in F1. I know he's been so great lately that it's easy to lose sight of that sometimes. But I don't see what the problem is. So, yeah. Now, I'm going to call an audible on this one. I'm going to talk about MotoGP on next week's episode because we're already at the 80-minute mark, and I think that's long enough, quite frankly. So I'm going to skip straight to our and finally segment for this episode of the podcast. The driver of the day poll was a little thing that came up before the Australian Grand Prix started. It was a little thing to encourage, obviously, more fan interaction and fan participation, so fans would get to choose an official driver of the day for Formula1.com. A third party was organising the votes. And who would have been driver of the day, Johnson, if the voters had their way?
Well, let's explain it like this. The official driver of the day was announced as Romain Grosjean. Yes, well-deserved, of course. But it goes a little bit deeper in that, because earlier in the day, before the votes were closed and the announcement was official, I believe it might have been the guys at Side Podcast, who are friends of the channel here, actually uncovered a way of tracking the real-time votes using an inspect element thing in Google Chrome, I believe it was. And at the time, Rio Haryanto was leading by something like 22,000 votes over Romain Grosjean's 17,000. And we got the final figures direct message to us after the vote, after Romain Grosjean was announced as the winner. Yeah, he didn't suddenly get miraculously more votes than Haryanto. Haryanto still should have beaten Grosjean, but apparently Max Verstappen, in the last 4 or 5 hours before the vote closed, shot up to 240,000 votes. And I found it hilarious how when they announced Grosjean as the winner, they had to have an asterisk saying, yeah, any repeat votes or votes that we believe are spam weren't counted. I was like, yeah. Yeah, you really don't say. I mean, everyone could see there was no vote verification for this. There was, you know, you could just spam the vote as much as you wanted. Everyone could see this thing was going to get abused to shit right from the get-go. And we had Rio Haryanto, we had Indonesian fans astroturfing for Rio Haryanto, like, mad. We all knew this was going to become a popularity contest. That's why Dale Earnhardt Jr. has won the most popular driver award for about the last 20 years in NASCAR. This is, it was always going to be that way, so... Yeah, it was kind of funny in the end, really.
Yeah, I mean, we've come to the conclusion that I think voting polls and fan votes in general just don't really work. I remember the NBA All-Star game earlier this year where Kobe Bryant was the leading vote-getter despite being largely mediocre for the Lakers, obviously, because he's already announced his retirement. People want to see Kobe Bryant one more time in the All-Star game as a fan vote, despite the fact, obviously, on performance alone, he would never make the All-Star game on merit. Also, it happened in a case where on the Western Conference, Draymond Green was robbed of a starting spot because of Zaza Pachulia. And Zaza Pachulia, who was a backup center for the Dallas Mavericks, he only got a boost because the musician Wyclef Jean posted a video on his Twitter about it saying to vote for Zaza. And he very nearly was a starter in the All-Star game, almost purely because of Kobe Bryant's vote taking his spot away. Also, on the Eastern side, Pau Gasol was 360 votes away from being a starter and instead did not make the All-Star game, period, as Carmelo Anthony was the one that outbeat him. And King, I'm sure you've got a story about a fan vote in the MLB, whatnot, with the Kansas City Royals, right?
Yeah, the Kansas City Royals last year. I think the starting lineup had 8 out of 9 of the starters being from the Kansas City Royals.
And the entire purpose of an All-Star game.
and they crushed a record for most ballots submitted. And this was the first ever year they decided not to have paper ballots anymore, and it was going to be all online balloting. They crushed the ballot record by, I think, over 100 million ballots. So it was what? Like, yeah, the record was back in 2012. It was 391 million ballots. I think the final count was over 500 million ballots submitted for the All-Star game.
Wow. Half a billion ballots for a baseball All-Star game. That's ridiculous. So
can I just say, bringing it back to the Formula One vote, I've got the results sent through here, the raw data. Some of them are just hilarious. Apparently, Rubens Barrichello got 2. Sebastian Vettel got 1, apparently. I'm not sure if that's correct. And guess who got more than both of them?
Go on.
Boaty McBoatface on 8.
Hey!
There's some bizarre stats in here. It's an absolute farce. It's absolutely ridiculous.
But sporting organisations, listen to me good, don't do fan votes online. They just don't work.
Open to abuse, it's ridiculous.
Somebody will crack the ballot box and it just doesn't work. But congrats to Grosjean for being the true winner of Driver of the Day, which makes perfect sense. Sorry, Haryanto, we just don't like you very much around here. Right, that will just about wrap it up for this episode of Motorsport 101. Like I said, we'll talk MotoGP on next week's show. I'll see if Sadebi's got the episode off. I might be able to pull him in for a taping because he's my biking cousin, so to speak. Thanks very much for listening. You can follow us, as always, on Twitter. Me at Harrison101HD, Johnson at AJ_Bumblesports, and Ryan King at Ryan Eric King. That's 2 Ks, by the way. His phone goes off in the background because that's clearly his follower count is blowing up as a result of this episode. we'll be back next week to talk MotoGP and probably not much else because it's just going to be a quiet week anyway. But we'll see what happens. I want to say a big thanks to everyone that's been watching on YouTube. We've got over 10,000 YouTube views now, as well as over 4,000 players on SoundCloud. You guys are fantastic. Please keep supporting the show. You guys are fantastic in that regard. And also, on Patreon, I'm very proud to announce the show is now 100% funded by you, the listeners of the show. So, massive thank you to everybody that supported us on Patreon so far. We are now literally self-sufficient. We can now actually do the show without worrying about making money. So, Thank you for believing in us and our products. We do genuinely appreciate it so, so much. And also, we've put a new goal on Patreon now. If we go to the point where we get to $90 a month in fan support, we are going to live stream episodes of the podcast. So, yeah, we could actually take you guys' comments and feedback live as we tape, which would be pretty crazy as well in its own right. But we want to see if there's more of a proof of concept for it first. So that's why we've set a bigger Patreon target for it. If we get to that goal, that is what we will do from here on in. But again, a massive thank you to everyone supporting us. We can't do this without you. I want to say big thanks obviously to Ryan and Adam for their big support, and shout out to Zara as well. I'm not going to mention her because she does all our podcast artwork and she's fantastic as well. So massive thanks to everybody involved in the podcast to this point going forward, and thank you very much for listening. And until next time, I've been Andre Harrison, he's been Ryan King, the other guy's been Adam Johnson. We'll catch you guys next time. Bye.
I cannot believe
you are the world champion!
Get Buddy Big Boat Face to the Arctic, please.
Harry Anto. Harry Anto. Actually, that was more worthy of a bullshit chant.